very strongly on anybody who disseminates data beyond the borders that the government deems appropriate, whether it's corporate or government data. And so for Stephen Kim, it became a kind of, he described it to me as like a brutal calculus. Okay, if I plead guilty and get 13 months in jail, that's it. I'll be out maybe after good behavior after 11 months. If I take this to trial, if I go to trial, I could end up in jail for 12 years. It'll be another $1 million in legal fees that I don't have the money to pay for. Which is the better route to go? And he took the route of pleading guilty and taking the 13-month sentence.
And what happened to James Rosen, the Fox reporter?
He is a very well-known Fox reporter still.
He was under investigation.
Yeah, well, James Rosen, and this is one of the aspects of the case that got actually more attention than what happened to Stephen Kim, is what happened to James Rosen, which is the government, in order to acquire emails, James Rosen's emails, more than they actually already had, they applied for a search warrant. And in the search warrant, they referred to Rosen as a potential co-conspirator in violating the Espionage Act. They accused him of basically kind of being this minstrel who was trying to operate a spy ring with Stephen Kim, collecting data and maybe unnamed other people collecting data. Rosen came that close to being indicted himself. When this was revealed that the government, A, called him an unindicted co-conspirator, and B, got his cell phone records, got his emails, tracked his physical movements. When this was finally revealed, and this came out in 2013, it was a huge controversy in the press because it was taken legitimately so as an attack on the freedom of the press.
You had James Rosen at Fox and James Risen at the New York Times.
Yes, it can get confusing
at
times. Very different stories and very different journalists, but there was something very similar in both of their cases, which is that the force of the government was brought to bear on journalists in order to connect them to crimes or get them to talk about alleged crimes.
And meanwhile, Stephen Kim continues to serve this 13 months in jail in Cumberland, Maryland.
He is in jail.
That does it for the show. Peter Maas, award-winning investigative journalist, will link to his piece at The Intercept called Destroyed by the Espionage Act. Stephen Kim spoke to a reporter. Now he's in jail. This is his story. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You've been listening to Democracy Now! Here on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, your volunteer-produced KBOO Evening News. But first, these important messages.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven, and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con alguien.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Malcolm X, playing at the Clinton Street Theater February 21st and the 22nd at 7 p.m. Starring Denzel Washington, this biographical film about Malcolm X by Spike Lee will be playing to honor the 50th anniversary of Malcolm X assassination. That's the film, Malcolm X, playing at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, on Saturday, February 21st, and Sunday, February 22nd at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council approves a $15 an hour minimum wage for most city workers.
The U.S. government decides to provide weaponized drones to allied countries.
As the first anniversary of the fatal mudslide in Oso, Washington approaches, survivors file a lawsuit against the state and the company that manages the forest.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 18th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The Portland City Council today voted to approve a $15 an hour minimum wage for most city employees. The council heard testimony from many community members in favor of the measure, including a number of people who said that the measure does not go far enough. Here's a sample of the testimony at today's city council meeting.
Jamie Partridge with 15 Now, and we're very excited about this step forward in producing a $15 wage for a number of workers at the contracted with the city and city workers. And we encourage you to step out and declare your support for the $15 movement citywide, statewide. I would suggest that with the bill before the state legislature, which has a 3-year phase in, that you can do this in 3 years. You can raise the workers at the city to 15 in 3 years. And that, of course, there have been several different options suggested, not only the $4.6 million ongoing surplus, but other creative ways of raising revenue. And taxing wealth and taxing income is something that the city can do and is not doing.
My name is Melissa Villano. I'm a branch organizer with Socialist Alternative here in Portland. Thank you for the chance to speak today. I hope the city council, and especially the mayor, realizes the truly historic opportunity that lies before them today and in the future. Since Seattle City Council member Shama Sawan and Socialist Alternative first launched the 15 Now campaign in Seattle, this movement has had a transformative effect on the mood of the working class in this country. We have seen mass mobilization of working class people fighting for 15 from Portland to San Francisco to Mobile, Alabama, to most recently Minneapolis, where this past Sunday night, City Council member Alondra Cano, a Democrat, gave her full public endorsement for a $15 minimum wage. As the council has heard today, working people are suffering now. This is not some abstract notion that needs to be debated. You just had a city worker testify to the council that she requires food stamps in order to eat. If that's not a crisis, I don't know what is. This kind of dismal economic reality doesn't just impact the low-wage workers themselves. When workers are forced to go on social services, the repercussions are felt throughout the local economy, from an increase in the homeless population to mental health issues to the dismal condition of our city streets, and by extension, a community that resists taxation as a matter of survival. We appreciate the City Council taking up this issue and hope that it continues to work fast and with the full resources at its disposal. And just on the subject of revenue that Commissioner Frantz spoke about in response to Seamus Cook, if the present economic system requires working people to live in poverty, then maybe we need a new system.
We've heard a lot of testimony today about how we should move faster and farther, and actually you have no one up here, I don't believe, who doesn't want to move faster and farther. But if I can take a phrase from you, in the present economic system that we're in, we can't deficit spend. We can only spend money that we actually have. And as you know, I'm now working on my third budget. One of my jobs as mayor is to propose the budget each time, and then we as a community and as a council discuss it. In my first budget, in 2013, we cut 155 full-time positions in the city budget because we had to balance our books. About 50 of those came from the police bureau, 26 of them came from the fire bureau. We fortunately got a federal grant, a short-term federal grant, to cover those 26 firefighter positions for 2 years. And then we did cut some positions in parks. Last year's budget, we added back one position in the police bureau, none in the fire bureau, and a few in parks. I don't remember the number, but it was a handful, right? Not a lot. In other words, we're still net less workers than we had in 2012, okay, on a balanced books basis. Now, Commissioner Fritz has quite rightly and very clearly raised this issue of part-time workers, and it's come up here as well. And again, none of us is interested in going slowly for slowly's sake, but I'm looking for ideas for how we move faster. They include new revenue. I heard that, and Commissioner Novick and I have been demonstrating how popular ideas for new revenue actually are. We're not going to stop talking about new revenue because we need it. But, you know, it doesn't exactly fall out of the sky politically when one brings up the subject. So I want to call on you and ask me and other organizations, Jamie Drew as well, to help us think through, along with the task force that Commissioner Fritz is going to be assembling, how do we keep going here? Part of the answer to that is going to be the better economy is giving us a better budget. The forecast says we're not going to have another year like 2013 anytime soon, and I'm really happy about that. But it's not getting better so fast that we're going to simply be able to solve the problem with, you know, with cash flow. So we're looking for creative ideas from the activist community as well as from our own budget folks, like the folks we've heard from today, about how we do this. But the rules are of how we do this is that 90% or better, and I think it's 93% of the general fund budget goes to police, fire, and parks. And most of the cost of those three bureaus' budgets is payroll. So it's a difficult box that we're in. Box is getting bigger. I like that. But it isn't infinite. So your thoughts about how we get creative, not just that we should, but how, I'm very interested in hearing. I'm really happy that I get to preside over bigger budgets for as far as the eye can see, but they're not that much bigger. So for what it's worth, we want to, and now and later, yes, please, now and later, we want to call on you for ideas.
Has the City Council ever reexamined the tax breaks that you give to businesses for coming here?
We don't basically give tax breaks for businesses coming here. We use urban renewal money from tax increment districts that has to be spent in that district on projects, usually public works projects, in that district. The conventional wisdom is we write checks to business. Not true. It almost never is the case. The only time that the city is ever involved in a direct subsidy to business is in what's called an enterprise zone, and I don't think we've done one in at least 3 years. So it's mostly money in and money out for personnel in our budget.
That was testimony from today's City Council meeting in Portland on the issue of a $15 minimum wage for city employees. The council approved the measure 5-0.
The Portland City Council voted today to pass a complete ban on smoking in city parks and nature areas. This ban will begin in July, and it will apply to more than 200 parks and nature areas in and around Portland. The ban will include tobacco, e-cigarettes, marijuana, and vaping products. Smoking in forbidden areas could lead to a citation, but city officials say that this is unlikely because the ban is mostly being implemented for public health reasons. Commissioner Dan Saltzman was the only one to vote against the ban, arguing that it was unenforceable and would just lead to dissent between police officers and smokers. City officials say that there will be a 5-month grace period to educate offenders about the new rule. It's not been said how much the city plans to spend on signs and enforcement methods.
Portland residents Mary Postlethwaite, Spencer Urban of the City Club of Portland, and Mary Pavito of Neighbors for Clean Air addressed City Council today regarding diesel engine air pollution. New regulations being put into effect in California may lead to phased-out equipment being shipped to Oregon and put into use.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Mayor Hales and the other members of the commission. I want to be very clear. We're asking the city for two things. The first is that the City Council today take immediate action to reduce the most dangerous air toxics by supporting the legislation this session that would phase out the operation of old diesel engines in Oregon. The second is join us in crafting a clean air future that's safe and equitable for all Portland citizens by establishing a clean air task force to address the air quality challenges Portland will face as a result of growth and climate adaptations. While action this year is critical to stem the dumping of older equipment from California in the wake of adoption of strict diesel rules in that state this year, the city also needs to recognize that the negative effects of air toxics unique to city environments will be exacerbated by urban effects of climate change, like heat islands and deteriorating neighborhood air quality for years to come. And so I'm asking the city today to make a commitment to meaningful action to reduce toxic air pollution by establishing an air toxics task force. This task force should be populated by the tremendous resources we have right here in Portland, like research teams at Portland State University, who can explore evidence-based solutions and actions that the city can take, as well as influence state and regional policies and ensure the livability of all Portland neighborhoods against the known and real hazards that currently exist and will be worsened by climate impacts. When I started this work as a private citizen, the biggest challenges about addressing any air pollution problem, whether it's an industrial point source or the air pollution caused by the tangled web of transportation infrastructure and freight movement, was that unlike water, our current air pollution problems are nearly 100% legal. This despite the fact that Multnomah County Health deems diesel alone to be the number one environmental contributor to the three leading causes of death in the county. Diesel particulate emissions account for 460 deaths a year in Oregon, and those deaths and other non-fatal health costs such as hospitalization and lost workdays cost the state $3.5 billion annually. I recognize the city's limitations in the regulations of air emissions, and in fact, I share them. But as a citizen who's pursued evidence-based advocacy, I have been heartened by the progress we can make against something that is often considered too complex to solve. Since we began, we have helped individual companies find opportunities for meaningful reductions in emissions, and we've pushed our state to do a better job at enforcing its own rules. I implore the city to join our ranks, first by supporting the statewide rules on diesel, and second by establishing the Air Toxics Task Force. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor Hales and commissioners. I'm Spencer Ehrman, and I'm here today on behalf of the City Club of Portland. I had the opportunity with colleagues from our research committee on air toxic regulation to appear before you some 18 months ago, where we presented the report and our findings, our conclusions and recommendations. Since then, City Club has been very active in the community in advocating for the implementation of those recommendations. We, along with Neighbors for Clean Air, have helped form a coalition of county health professionals and other NGOs to further the cause of reducing air toxic in our airshed, particularly as respects diesel. City Club has a legislative agenda this year, which includes supporting two bills that are being proposed by Portland area legislators to have a significant impact on reducing air toxics. As Mary referred to a few minutes ago, it's important that we begin to change out the old diesel equipment, and these bills would help effect those changes. We would hope that that the City Council would be willing to stand behind the rest of us in furthering this legislative agenda this year. City Club continues to attend to this issue, and we will continue to do so during the coming months and hopefully years. So I just wanted to check back in with you today, let you know of some of the progress that we've been making. We're very encouraged since we published our report to see that we do have some legislation opportunities in Salem. Again, appreciating the limitations on the city for regulation, we would be wholly in support of Mary's suggestion for a task force to be based locally and begin to investigate and explore ways in which the community can begin to have a significant impact in this area.
I'm here with Village Gardens. I'm a community health worker. I never knew that the air that we breathe is killing us. That is appalling to me. Every day I turn on the TV and I see somebody got shot, but I never have heard of it. Anybody telling me about the types of toxins that are in our air that are killing us so fast. There's been a study shown that air toxins and pollutants and poisons in the air hurt the cognitive part of your brain in children, and it has been shown to cause depression.
Thank you. I appreciate all three of you being here. Could you elaborate just a moment on the
the recent development here in terms of California changed their standards, and that is actually causing people to relocate. Is it just trucks, or is it also the construction equipment, railroad equipment? Is it all the above?
All the above.
They're moving that to Oregon or elsewhere because it's no longer legal to use it in California. Do I understand that right?
Yeah, so California has been in the process of implementing phased-in rules that would restrict and eliminate the use of the older pre-2007 diesel engines that are the biggest sources of particulate exhaust pollution.
Portland Democrat State Senator Michael Dembro is crafting legislation to limit the dumping of the estimated 350,000 diesel trucks being phased out in California from ending up on Oregon roads.
The Oregon Senate approved a bill Tuesday to extend the state's clean fuel standard, but now Senate Republicans are trying to stop the bill from moving forward. The bill passed despite 4 hours of motions, delays, and obstructions by Senate Republicans. The Republicans had tried to link the bill to the scandal involving now former Governor John Kitzhaber, who left office today. Democratic legislators downplayed the link to the scandal and called the delay a show of political theater. The climate change program sets increasingly lower limits on the carbon intensity of vehicle fuels. John Kitzhaber's fiancée, Sylvia Hayes, was not involved with creating the program, but she accepted money from a San Francisco-based foundation to promote it. The Energy Foundation, which promotes energy efficiency and renewable energy, paid Hayes $40,000 in 2013 for work on a variety of climate-related projects. Under that contract, Hayes created a communications strategy to support Oregon's Clean Fuels program that included writing op-ed pieces and letters to the editor and pushing for media coverage. Hayes' eight-month contract with the foundation is among those under scrutiny, as they appear to conflict with her unpaid work advising Kitzhaber on those same topics. Tuesday's vote came 4 days after a federal grand jury in Portland launched a sweeping investigation into whether Kitzhaber and Hayes personally benefited from policies implemented in the governor's office, including the clean fuel standard. Kitzhaber's resignation took effect at 10 a.m. Wednesday, and Secretary of State Kate Brown will take over now as governor.
Response crews in West Virginia are on the scene of a train derailment that took place on February 15th. The train derailment took place near Mount Carbon next to the Kanawha River, and the train cars are still on fire 3 days later. The content on the trains is still unknown to the public. Response crews in West Virginia have deployed about 500 feet of containment boom as a precautionary measure to limit potential impact on the environment. Officials say they are continuing to deploy environmental protective and monitoring measures on land, air, and in the nearby Kanawha River, as well as a creek near the tracks. This is the second environmental disaster in West Virginia in less than a month. On January 27th, a gas pipeline burst, creating what appeared to be a large fireball burning in the sky. There's no word yet on what caused that explosion, which took place in a pipeline owned by Enterprise Products LP. The company is based in Texas and oversees 50,000 miles of pipelines throughout the U.S.
The mass animal and bird deaths along the west coast of America continues to worsen. Marine mammal strandings where the animals beach themselves has risen to levels 10 times greater than normal. This is the third straight year that marine animals and bird deaths have increased to record levels. The mass deaths have hit starfish, Pacific oysters, scallops, sardines, and crayfish, along with other shellfish in the Pacific Ocean along the western coast of America. Animals and seabirds that depend on the shellfish as a major food source are increasingly washing up along ocean beaches, showing signs of starvation. Levels of strandings for sea lions and seals are up 10 times over normal levels, and scientists are struggling to understand why the mass die-offs are occurring. In the last 3 years, over 70% of all sea lions have, or at least their pups, have died, including over 15,000 in this year alone. So far, they've ruled out any viruses or bacteria as causing the strandings and starvation of the animals and birds. Many scientists believe that warming oceans and ocean acidification are the major culprits to the die-offs, while others point to bioaccumulation of radioactivity from the Fukushima nuclear meltdown as a potential cause. Fukushima melted down 4 years ago, and over 400,000 tons of highly radioactive water flowed into the Pacific Ocean and is beginning to approach the west coast of America. A recently released study by the National Academy of Sciences found that mass die-offs, defined as a die-off of at least 90%, have greatly increased for marine invertebrates, fish, and birds over the last few decades, but has not increased for mammals.
Relatives of a half dozen people killed in the massive Oso, Washington mudslide have filed a lawsuit against the state of Washington, Snohomish County, and a logging company, saying they helped turn a historically unstable hillside into a wall of death. The March 2014 slide, which covered a square mile of the Stillaguamish River Valley, killed 43 people, destroyed 49 buildings, and closed a state highway for 6 months. The slide was the worst one in U.S. history, not caused by an earthquake, volcano, or dam failure. The suit, filed in Seattle, asks for unspecified damages from the state, the county, and Grandy Lake Forest Associates, LLC. Attorney Karen Willey argued that clear-cutting performed by the timber company in 2004 was the main cause of a 2006 slide on the same hillside, and that the 2006 slide destabilized the hill and made last spring's slide more likely. Between 1937 and 2006, there were 9 significant landslides in the exact same spot, known as River Mile 20, on the North Fork of the Stillaguamish River. The suit alleges that after the 2006 landslide moved the river 800 feet, federal, state, and county officials moved the river back to its previous location, setting the stage for disaster. The complaint also cited several scientific reports that warned of the potential for catastrophic hillside failure, including a 1999 draft report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and a 2010 report commissioned by a local tribe. At least one other similar Oso lawsuit has been filed, and Willey said she is urging the judge to consolidate them. The state plans to fight both lawsuits, and the company that manages the forest said they were not to blame, that the Oso mudslide was, quote, naturally caused catastrophic event.
A 40-year-old Kaiser man died yesterday after a metal beam fell and broke through the cab of the crane that he was operating. Medical officials say that blunt force trauma to the head killed Christopher Pearson. The accident happened on Northeast 2nd Avenue near the railroad tracks. The Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division is further investigating the incident. An OSHA spokesperson said that Pearson was lifting a steel beam during a retaining wall construction project. The beam dropped and fell into the cab. Pearson had worked for Axis Crane for 3 years.
Families of murder victims are supporting a measure to abolish the death penalty in Washington state. Proponents of capital punishment argue that appeals processes tend to be costly and drawn out, which only prolongs the pain of the crime. More than a dozen people testified today before a House committee in favor of a House bill that would replace capital punishment with lifelong prison sentences. This proposal comes after Governor Jay Inslee imposed a moratorium on death sentences in Washington last year. Inslee said that he supports the bill to completely eliminate capital punishment. The House committee is set to vote on the bill tomorrow.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the Boo at 5:45, followed by Out Loud at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cooler with a high of 55 and showers likely in the afternoon. There will be a 55% chance of rain. Today in history, on the 18th of February in 1937, dust storms hit 5 states, Kansas, Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas, and New Mexico. Within a few days, a dozen deaths had occurred. Likewise, influenza and pneumonia patients were easily affected, as the dust storms had made breathing difficult for them. The dust storms were so severe that people could taste the dirt and other substance in their food at dinner time. Furthermore, clouds of dust were so thick that they blocked out the light of the sun. Also today, on February 18, 1930, astronomer Clyde Tombaugh located a new planet while in the observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and named it after the Greek god of the underworld, Pluto. Our quote of the day is from H. Jackson Brown Jr., who said, "Don't say you don't have enough time. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Helen Keller, Michelangelo, Mother Teresa, Leonardo da Vinci, Thomas Jefferson, and Albert Einstein."
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Do the crime, do the time, goes the old saying. Unless, of course, the criminals are corporate executives. In those cases, the culprits are practically always given a get-out-of-jail-free card. Even the corporate crimes that produce horrible injuries, illnesses, death, etc., are routinely settled by fines and payoffs from the corporate treasury. with no punishment of the honchos who oversee what amount to crime-for-profit syndicates. The only bit of justice in these money settlements is that some of them have become quite large, with multi-billion dollar, quote, punitive damages meant to deter the perpetrators from doing it again. Yet, the same bad corporate actors seem to keep at it. What's going on here is a game of winking and nodding in which corporate criminals know that those headline-grabbing assessments come with a secret escape hatch. Congress has generously written the law so corporations can deduct much of their punitive payments from their income taxes. As Senator Pat Leahy points out, this tax loophole allows corporations to wreak havoc and then write it off as a cost of doing business. For example, oil giant BP certainly wreaked havoc with its careless oil rig explosion in 2010, killing 11 workers, deeply contaminating the Gulf of Mexico, and devastating the livelihoods of millions of people along the Gulf Coast. So, BP was socked with a punishing payout topping $42 billion. But, 80% of that is eligible for a tax deduction, a little fact that was effectively covered up by the bosses and politicians. This is Jim Hightower saying Senator Leahy has introduced legislation to lock down this escape hatch for thieves, killers, and executive suite villains. For more information on the moral outrage of ordinary taxpayers forced to subsidize corporate criminals, contact USPIRG at USPIRG.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A human rights group has reached a settlement in a case filed on behalf of a single woman who said she was fired from her job at a religiously affiliated organization because she became pregnant. The American Civil Liberties Union filed the lawsuit for Jennifer Maldon, who was fired from her job as a cook for Inside Out, which is a Christian-based childcare organization in Ohio. Maldon said in the 2013 lawsuit that she was fired because the company had an unwritten rule against premarital sex. The allegations mentioned multiple instances of poor treatment towards single women who became pregnant while working at Inside Out. Male employees who became single fathers were not shown the same hostility. The lawsuit asked Inside Out to adopt a policy that prohibited pregnancy-based discrimination. Maldon also sought damages. The parties reached a settlement, which included Inside Out editing its employment policies.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Postal Workers Union starts talks on a new contract with the U.S. Postal Service today with actor-activist Danny Glover in their corner. These postal labor talks come as management is carrying out a policy of slashing jobs, closing mail facilities, and dismantling the vast postal network with piecemeal privatization. Danny Glover's parents were postal workers.
The post office has given people the opportunity to create a middle-class existence. It has allowed them to prosper. It has allowed them to send their children to college, to buy homes. That's what the post office has done. The post office is one of the leading and perhaps the largest employer within that federal system that has allowed them to do that. There's an attempt now to take that away from us. There's an attempt to now remove that from possibilities, and that's what is happening right now.
Glover is motivated to stand with postal workers and other unions because he grew up in a union household where he learned to honor labor and human rights. Glover says workers asserting their rights today are part of an historic human rights struggle, a narrative that also includes the rich and powerful relentlessly trying to crush those movements.
And the narrative has always been, whether it's the Magna Carta, whether it's the fight for the Bill of Rights, is to disenfranchise people, to bring them to the lowest level they can in terms of livelihood, in terms of maintaining themselves. That's been the drama. And to allow the wealth to accumulate in the hands of just a few. Now, Dr. King always talked about a union. He said the best anti-poverty program he knew was the union.
The Teamsters Wednesday announced the formation of a rapid response team to help port truckers get unemployment compensation if West Coast ports are closed by either a lockout or a strike. Teamsters Port Driver Campaign Director Nick Weiner says thousands of port truckers are misclassified as independent contractors instead of employees, making it harder for them to get unemployment compensation.
We've been heartened that over the past several months, we've been able to help
some port truck drivers who have been told they were independent contractors qualify and receive unemployment benefits. State officials can't predetermine every individual case, but from our perspective, the situation of port drivers are virtually identical from company to company. So we're confident that they will be able to qualify. It's just helping them through the process.
The ILWU has been attempting to get a new labor contract for 20,000 West Coast dock workers since the current one expired last summer. The Pacific Maritime Association has locked out dock workers from loading and unloading ships sporadically for a few days at a time, even as the labor talks continue.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The University of Massachusetts has decided to reverse its prior decision to ban students from Iran and will now accept those students. This follows an earlier decision to ban Iranian students from the undergraduate programs in engineering and natural sciences by the university. In that decision, the university cited U.S. sanctions against Iran. A university spokesman said the school recognized that the decision has caused difficulties, but they were obliged to adhere to the law. But with the reassurance of federal officials that they would not be prosecuted for accepting the students, the university has decided that they will not move forward with the discriminatory policy to ban those students.
A U.S. military court just overturned a former Guantanamo Bay prisoner's terrorism conviction. Australian David Hicks has pleaded guilty in March 2007 to providing material support for terrorism. That was part of a plea bargain that allowed him to leave Guantanamo, avoiding further torture and detainment. Last year, a U.S. appeal court ruled that giving material support to terrorism is not a viable offense by military commissions. Yet, prosecutors argued that despite this ruling, Hicks' conviction should stand because his plea deal included an agreement that he would not appeal. The U.S. Court of Military Commission Review unanimously rejected the prosecutor's argument. Hicks' lawyer said that the decision is confirmation that Hicks is innocent of any crime and that he is finally free of Guantanamo.
Even as reports of U.S. drone strikes continue in North Waziristan, an apparent violation of Pakistani sovereignty, the Obama administration has announced that it will begin the process of opening up drone exports to trusted partner nations. Among the criteria for export approval are included the requirements that countries seeking to acquire armed drones use the systems in accordance with the international humanitarian and human rights law, and that the drones will be used when there is a basis for the use of force, such as for national defense. An additional requirement is that the recipient nations do not use the drones for surveillance of their domestic populations. These changes come amid increased export of Chinese drone technology and the maturing ability of the United Kingdom and Israel to use armed drones. Several states are reported to be developing surveillance drones, including Pakistan, Iran, and India.
Egypt has called for an unbacked intervention in Libya following airstrikes on targets of the so-called Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known by its Arabic acronym Daesh. The strikes were made in retaliation for the murder of 21 Egyptian Christians this past weekend. A video released by Daesh shows the Egyptian prisoners lined up along a beach and simultaneously beheaded. The president of Egypt stated that the only option for dealing with Daesh is to create a global coalition to confront the extremist threat. He had come under fire in recent weeks by the Egyptian Coptic Christian community for failing to take action on the issue of the Egyptian Christian prisoners.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, located online at www.imemc.org. Today's news brief is for Wednesday, February 18, 2015. I'm Alexandra Halaby, sitting in for Ghassan Banoura. Israeli soldiers stationed on military towers across the border fence opened fire on Tuesday evening on Palestinian farmers and their lands in central Gaza. Eyewitnesses said the soldiers fired rounds of live ammunition on the farmers, forcing them to leave. The attack caused no injuries. The attack is part of repeated violations against the Palestinians and their land, especially in areas close to the border. In addition to ongoing violations against the fishers in Palestinian territorial waters and even while on shore. On Tuesday morning, soldiers opened fire towards Palestinian shepherds near the cemetery in Jabalia in the northern Gaza Strip, while Israeli gunboats targeted fishing boats in Khan Yunis on Monday at night in Gaza's southern region. Israeli forces abducted overnight 9 Palestinians and summoned 2 children from various West Bank districts, according to reports by security sources and a local activist. In Taisir, Israeli forces reportedly uprooted dozens of Palestinian-owned olive trees. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, police stormed a house belonging to Arafat Abu Isbaytan in Jabal al-Zaytun's Al-Tur neighborhood, overlooking the old city where they summoned 2 children. Isbaytan was served with an order summoning his 2 children, Mohammed, age 12, and Ibrahim, age 10, to appear before Israeli intelligence in West Jerusalem. Police officers stationed at Bab al-Nathr, which leads to Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, detained a Palestinian woman while she was exiting the compound. The woman remains unidentified. The incident occurred just shortly after Palestinian Muslim women attempted to confront groups of extremist settlers who stormed the compound from the Mughrabi Gate. In Bethlehem, Israeli forces kidnapped a Palestinian young man after breaking into and ransacking his house in the Jabal al-Mawila neighborhood. The detainee was identified as Yahya Jado, age 29. A group of Jewish settlers, reportedly from the Metzad settlement near Bethlehem, uprooted over 500 newly planted olive saplings on Wednesday near Hebron. The damaged fields belonging to the Al-Aida family, local activists said. The owners found the damaged trees in the morning while going out to check the land, which is near the Gush Etzion settlement block. The Regional Construction and Planning Committee of the Jerusalem City Council approved Wednesday the establishment of a trash dump area on around 520 dunams or 128.49 acres of Palestinian lands. The area is inhabited by Bedouins who will be removed and relocated, in addition to lands owned by the Palestinians in the area. The Jerusalem City Council and Israel Land Authority set the plan that would be established near the old road that leads to Male Adumim. The Israeli Supreme Court on Wednesday overruled a ban on a member of the Knesset from Israel's Palestinian community, as well as another on an extreme right-wing Jewish activist from running in next month's election, an official said. Last month, Israel's 4 Arab parties decided to fight the March 17th election as a single bloc. Hanin Zoabi in 7th on a united list, which opinion polls suggest could win between 10 and 13 seats in the 120-member Knesset. Some 1.3 million Palestinian citizens live inside the official borders of Israel and compose about 20% of the population. They are the descendants of 160,000 people who remained on their land during the mass displacement of the remaining Palestinian population during the creation of the Israeli state in 1948. And yesterday, the Undergraduate Senate of California's Stanford University voted to pass a resolution to divest from the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The resolution, entitled A Resolution to Divest from Companies Violating Human Rights in Occupied Palestine, calls on Stanford to stop investing in multinational corporations facilitating human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. And that's the latest news today from the IMEMC News Center. This was the Wednesday, February 18th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Syed Banura and me, Alexandra Halaby, sitting in for Ghassan Banura.
Greece has only a few days to accept a European Union plan for reviving their economy. Meanwhile, there's ongoing speculation as to whether they will instead turn to Russia, China, or other nations they are aligned with for a more favorable offer. On Monday, Greece dismissed the latest EU offer to extend the current bailout plan for 6 months, declaring it absurd. EU finance ministers will meet again with Greek representatives on February 20th to either extend the current bailout program, sign a new deal, or force Greece out of euro currency.
The world's oceans are accumulating plastics at the rate of nearly 9 million tons every year. Visually, that would be 5 plastic grocery bags stuffed with plastic for every foot of coastline in the world. This figure is much higher than originally thought due to the fact that much of the plastics sink to the bottom of the ocean and are hidden in remote places that the scientists have not sampled in their studies. China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Sri Lanka are responsible for more than half of the plastics in the ocean. There is only one industrialized Western country on the list, the United States, at number 20. The plastic trash from the United States and Europe are coming in the form of litter. It's predicted that if the developing Asian nations do not learn to clean up their plastic debris, then by 2025, the accumulated amount of plastic trash in the oceans will reach about 170 million tons.
The World Bank has released the newest findings on the amount of gas flaring that occurred worldwide last year. The process of flaring burns off gas and natural gas that is released during the drilling and extraction of oil, but not captured by the drilling method. The findings show that flaring burned over 140 billion cubic meters of gas last year, creating over 350 million tons of carbon dioxide. That amount of carbon dioxide is equal to the emissions from more than 70 million cars. The flared gas is contaminated with numerous toxic compounds and cancer-causing carcinogens and is a prime contributor to acid rain. The world's largest flarers by country are Russia, America, Nigeria, Iran, Iraq, and Venezuela. Processes do exist to capture the gas that is flared, but are economically costly and cut into corporate profits. The global community and countries worldwide have recognized for years the dangers of flared gas, and in 2002 created the Global Gas Flaring Reduction Partnership. The organization has a goal of eliminating all flaring by the year 2030. Despite small gains in decreasing flaring in recent years, the drop in oil prices has caused many oil drilling sites to start flaring again in order to cut costs.